Good morning, everybody. Today, I want to share with you a subject you possibly know about quite a lot, but I want to look at it from a different way. You'd be familiar with a question that King David asked God. The question you will read is in Psalm chapter 8, verse 4, and it reads thus: What is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? But when I was looking this up, I discovered that that's not the only place that statement's made. In fact, in Job chapter 7, verse 17, we have the same sentiment. Here Job is saying, What is man that you should magnify him, and that you should set your heart on him? Again, in Job chapter 15, verse 14, he re-asks the question, but in a different way. What is man that he should be clean? And what is he that is born of woman that he should become righteous? And of course, I want to take another one. Psalm 144, verse 3. O Lord, what is man that you take knowledge of him, and that you are mindful of him, and that you visit him, and that you esteem him? Sorry, I got that wrong. Got mixed up there in my own things. Today, I have a question for you. Or a title, rather, should we put it that way, if you like titles. It's called Mankind, the Image of God. And that's what we're going to look at now. You see, the Holy Spirit inspired that question throughout the scriptures for a number of different reasons. But basically, it was for people, as they read it, to ask that question of God. What is man? What is the purpose for God? Why does God have such an interest on us? Why does God want to work with us? What is it? And because the Holy Spirit actually inspired the question, he often inspires the answer too. And so I'd like to give you three aspects of answers that you will receive from differing levels of growth within Christianity. I've split them into three verses, three aspects: the child's view, the teenage or adolescent view, and the adult view. And the child's view is very simple to the question. It's because he loves us. We are important to him. He takes pleasure in us. He enjoys our company. He likes our singing. He enjoys being with us. He wants to give us things. He wants to spread his love out to us. That's the child's view. And it's the first view that we all start with. We become aware of God's instant love for us and how special that makes us feel. But then as we grow and mature and develop, we begin to take on the teenage or adolescent view. And we realize that it's not just lovey-dovey. We want to learn. We want to grow to know this wonderful God. We want to have a relationship with him. We want to become known to him and know of him. And we want to learn everything that he can teach us. We want to be able to take on the authority that he has, and to understand it, and to be able to explain it, and to be able to talk about it. And we throw ourselves into Bible study and teaching processes and all the rest. But there is a third answer to this question. And this is God's preferred one. It's the adult view. God sees in us his reflection throughout all of creation. Everywhere mankind goes is God reflected to all that was made. And that's what God's view of what a Christian is. That's why God is mindful of us. Because he has given us that wonderful opportunity to be his representatives. So, that's what I want to discuss with you today. The adult view. Our role as the image of God. So we could go back to that first question again. What was God's purpose in creating us? In Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, that's his answer immediately. God created man in his image. In the beginning, in the image of God, he created them, male and female. So, we see here that God made us in a particular fashion. He made us with a particular point of view in mind. In Genesis 9, verse 6, he again tells us he made man in the image of God. Now, you'll find that statement throughout different parts of the Bible. But I want to highlight that man was not a prototype blueprint. What do I mean by that? Well, cattle, when God decided he was going to make cattle, he decided, all right, we're going to have different types of cows, but we're also going to have oxen. We might have buffalo, maybe a few bison. You know, different things, but they're all cattle. They're all of the cattle kind. And cattle always remain of the cattle kind. When God decided to make fish, he decided to have a wide variety of fish. But guess what? All the fish are of the fish kind. They're all the same. They're all made of that one prototype blueprint of what a fish is able to do and what a fish's responsibilities are. Fish know what they are doing. They have no problem with that. He made fowl. He gave them the unique ability of being able to fly and do different things like that. And you know something? You never yet have found a fowl that wanted to be a cow. Haven't checked. But it's funny, but you do get those things. They're made in the one thing. But then he made man. And guess what? There's no blueprint for man. There is no mankind. God didn't make man after a mankind. He made it after the God kind. You're unique. Because officially, from a standpoint situation, cattle can remain because they've got a nice blueprint to go back to. Fish can remain, but you can't. You have to become according to your blueprint. And your blueprint is based on God himself. So you have great responsibility. Initially, you see, man is the physical representation of the God to all of creation. We know that God's invisible, don't we? We know that nobody can actually interact with God. God is holy, righteous, powerful. But God still saw that there was a need for his creation to be able to interact with him. So he felt that it was necessary to remind them about him. And you're that reminder. That's your purpose. You are the reminder of God. His image, his idols, his clay effigies that he breathed life into and placed on the earth to remind everything about him. So, how did God originally view mankind? Well, we know that he basically looked upon mankind as a child. He didn't look at them the way you would look at, the way you would look at a dog or a cat or an animal. He looked at them the way you would look at a child. He came to them in the cool of the evening. He talked to them. He spent time with them. He had a relationship with them. He didn't hide himself from them. He answered their questions. He ensured that everything was right with them. He enjoyed their company and showed so much of himself to them. We know this because we're told about it in Genesis chapter 3, verse 8. But man lost his right to represent God. And that's terrible. Man died in the Garden of Eden. And as a result of that, the vacuum caused left an opening for someone else to sit in the way. And that someone else, as we know, turned out to be Satan. He came and he set in and established his right to govern on this earth in man's place. And it's interesting, in Ezekiel chapter 9, verse 4, we have an interesting little verse. You might think it's out of sequence, but I think it's actually very poignant. For whosoever is chosen of all those living, there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. And that's what happens. We were the living lion until we died. But we've been replaced temporarily by a living dog. It can bark. It appears to be fierce and growly and all the rest. But really, you shouldn't be afraid of it. It can't eat you up. It can't totally destroy you. It only has limited ability. But we know we now have a living lion already in heaven, the Lion of Judah, who is alive, powerful, and ready to come back and teach that dog some new tricks. That's something that we have to become very aware of. Man lost all knowledge of his identity once he died. And as a result of that, he began to form images from his own imagination, because he still recognized that there had to be something more than him. You see, he had the intelligence, he had the understanding, he had the basic blueprint, if you like, of the God mind. So he was able to reason. And in that reasoning, he began to say, okay, there's something more than me here. There's something else. But he had lost, over the generations, he lost what God was and who God was. So what he did was he started to create gods in his own imagination. And if you look through some of the theologies of history of pagan religions, you realize that some ideas that man came up with are ridiculous. They've got gods with elephants' heads. They've got gods with three or four faces. They've got gods of all sorts of mystical creatures. Dragons are gods. All these things. Because in man's head, he began to reach out to look for what he thought God could be like, not realizing that all he had to do was look in a mirror, and he would have saw what God had already left as the image. In fact, this is what was happening, to put it in simple terms. The reality was that the image of God, which was true, was forming an image of falsehood to worship. And that's why God hates idolatry. He hates idols. He hates anything that is meant to represent him. Because there is only one acceptable representation that he has agreed to. And that's you. And that's what we have to remember. That's why God was so angry. And if you read through the scriptures, you find God's anger burns hottest against idolatry. He really does not like it. No matter how you wrap it up, that is the one thing that God hates the most. Yet it's the one thing that we continually keep coming across. In Exodus 20 verse 4, God tells us, you shall not make to yourself any graven image, anything that's in the heavens above, the earth beneath, or the waters under the earth. When Jesus was talking to the woman in the well, do you remember the Samaritan well, the Samaritan woman that Jesus was chatting to? He told her that the Father wished to be worshipped in spirit and truth. That's John chapter 4, verse 22. But what did he mean? Well, basically, we could translate it back to this. Spirit and truth. An intermediary and in full understanding. Without an intermediary and full understanding. So if we're worshipping in spirit, we don't have anything standing in our way between us and God. And if we have truth, then we understand everything, don't we? We understand the fullness of the thing. So it's without an intermediary and with a full understanding. He then said that the Jews worshipped using blood sacrifices. We worship what we know. We worship God. But they were using an intermediary because they understood the principle of sacrifice. They understood that it was necessary, because of their state, to make a sacrifice to God before they could come before him. So they had to use an intermediary at that time. The Samaritans, however, he said, you don't understand what you are worshipping. In other words, he was saying, you don't have any knowledge. You don't understand the principle of what's going down here. You don't realize what it's all about. But then he turned and he remembered, he said, but that's all just been wiped away now, because God wants you to worship in a different way. He wants you to worship him in the spirit and truth, without the intermediary, without the blood sacrifice, and with the full knowledge of understanding. And that's what he was being offered. But you know, Satan also deserves to be worshipped. He wants to be worshipped just like God is worshipped. And he wants to be worshipped in the same way as God is worshipped, but he has a problem. He can't ask you to worship him directly. He can't say to you, worship me with full knowledge of who I am. So he has to disguise the whole process. That's what was happening to Samaria. They were being disguised and didn't realize that what they were worshipping was falsehood. They weren't doing it right. They seemed to be doing all the same things, but because they weren't doing it where it was legal, they were doing it incorrectly. Satan deserves to be worshipped, but then again, so does man. Are you aware that mankind requires and desires worship? Have you ever considered that? No animal, no matter what type of animal you want to come up with, desires to be worshipped. It's not important to them. It's not something that we even consider. But we generally desire worship. You say, how do we desire worship? Well, there's a number of ways, but I'll get to those in a minute. I want to first of all remind you how Satan offered Christ all if he was willing to worship him. Again, that's Matthew 4, verse 8. But concerning men, Nimrod is believed to be the first human leader to desire to be worshipped as God. You'll find that in Genesis chapter 10, verse 8. Pharaoh in Egypt was declared to be a god, a son of a god, a representative of the gods on the earth. That's what Pharaoh was. So he was worshipped. Nebuchadnezzar, he built a statue, big gold statue, set it up and said everyone is to worship that. Because he wanted them to worship the statue? No, because the statue, it is believed, may well have been a representation of himself. And in that case, he was looking to be honored and glorified. For everyone could see the statue, turn to the statue, and it was like he was receiving all the worship and glory and praise. Again, you will read that in Daniel 3, verses 1 right through to 7. But you know, it's funny. Sometimes people want to be worshipped and aren't even fully aware of the fact that they do. Darius was a king who came after Nebuchadnezzar with the change of power from Babylonian to Persia. And he was a wise man. He understood things. He was a considerably good king. But he had a problem. He was vain. Ah, sadly was. So when all the presidents of the kingdom and prefects and satraps and the officials and governors had planned together to establish a royal law, they wanted him to make a strong ban that whosoever would ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, except king, should be put in the lion's den. He didn't realize that this was a trap being set up for Daniel. You'll read this story, Daniel chapter 6, verse 7. You see, what was actually happening here was, when he had come into power, he had set up a whole, if you like, government to look after the land. It consisted of about 120 people. And they all had different things. But he set over them three presidents, three individuals who would oversee everything. And of those three presidents, he picked one man of those three that would be head honcho, the guy in charge. And the reason he picked him was because this one was absolutely perfect. He could trust him. He was good. And his name was Daniel. And the people couldn't, these other guys, they could not get anything to bring an accusation against him with. So they knew the only thing they could do was to trick the king into making Daniel break the law. They had to trick the king into making Daniel break the law. And that's what happened there. Darius was tricked because he liked the idea that everyone would have to come and petition him for 30 days. He liked all the power that would give and the recognition of a new king, the power and authority. But he hadn't realized the trap. But God sorted out the trap. And the lions didn't eat Daniel. Roman emperors, at the time of Jesus Christ, were also worshipped as deities. The cult of emperor worship was very well established at that time. And in everywhere the Romans went, it was traditional to put up a statue of Caesar and to offer sacrifice to it and to give homage to it. The only place it didn't happen was Jerusalem, or was actually Judea, because it was against the law and custom of the people. So the only place it didn't happen was in Jerusalem. But Jews had a great problem everywhere else because it was expected. And they had to get special dispensation not to be taken and thrown into prison because they hadn't actually given the offerings to the big statue that stuck in the middle of the thing of Caesar. Emperor worship was very common. Today, getting back to this bit, it's not uncommon for individuals without rank, power or anything else to want the same type and form of worship. They want this worship from people who they consider should be giving them this worship. And the most common, believe it or not, is husbands. Husbands would like their wives to worship him. And they say, we have biblical authorization for this. No, you haven't. You really don't. But listen, I'll tell you more. They also want their children to worship them. They want their children to do exactly what they say, not have an opinion, sit down, do what I tell you, and behave. And when they don't, they get really angry. My power, my authority has been challenged. Now, we might take that with a wee bit of, you know, lackadaisical approach and say, well, we know, but it's not really worship, is it? It is when you become to the extent where a man would go out and beat his wife to a pulp or kill his children because they will not do what he tells them to do. That is demanding worship. And that's something that we have to understand about pagan worship. Pagan worship works on the same principle as the bully. The bully wants to be recognized in the school. He wants to have power and authority, but he feels inadequate in himself. And he's got an opportunity to enforce his power through force. The cycle continues, you see. It continues on and on. God did not create fear to be a natural aspect of his image. In other words, when a person meets you as a Christian, the first thing they shouldn't come to is, oh, I better do what I'm told because this person might have the power to command fire to fall from heaven and thump me. No. Let's be honest. That doesn't even come into their mind. They think that basically you're not someone to be scary of. At least that's how it's meant to be. You're not meant to be scary. Even though you do have fire, you do have authority, you do have right, you aren't using it as a stick. But idols do. And that's the problem. If you want to set up a worship of someone that's incorrect, the only way you can keep that going is through fear. And that's the scary bit. When Christianity also starts using fear to motivate its followers. Because the moment fear is introduced, Christianity is no longer reflecting God. And that's a sad aspect. We are reminded that God is love. 1 John chapter 4 verse 16. In 1 John chapter 4 verse 8 we have a more reflection of that. That God is love. The one who does not love has not known God, for God is love. There is, and I want to just share this with you, a proverb that we're all familiar with. It's Proverbs chapter 9 verse 10. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom and the knowledge, and the knowledge of holy is understanding. The holiness is understanding. Why do I say that's a misunderstood proverb? Well, basically because people think the fear means to be afraid of. I want to give you an example of what this actually means. You are aware that children, young children especially, can have irrational fears. One of the most common of these could be when they're away from home. They will suddenly, in the middle of the night, get afraid, frightened, cry, panic. And we call this homesickness. They want to be back with their parents. For some reason, they suddenly panic. They have been separated from their parents, and they want that assurance that the parents are okay, that they haven't gone up and died on them or left them or whatever. That's homesickness. The child has shown a fear. But the fear is not of the parent. The fear is of not having the parent. And this is the same fear that is related to God. Our fear of God should be not having contact with God. The fear of God leads to understanding. We should be aware of how important God is in our lives. And it should be something that we are dwelling as best of our ability to ensure that we keep that relationship good. That's why when we offend, when we step out of place, when we're arrogant, when we're stupid and tell lies, when we do anything, we automatically should say, sorry, I didn't mean that. I don't want anything to come between me and you. That attitude of being aware of the fact that our responsibility is to keep that relationship open shows our fear of God. Doesn't mean God's going to say, all right, I'm not having anything more to do with you. Because he won't. It's not him. Parents don't, I say this cautiously, don't generally disown their children because they're disobedient. I mean, if that was the case, we'd have got rid of babies at the very beginning, wouldn't we? Because you say, shut up. See, the whole point of the thing is, we understand that, especially children, take time to grow and learn and understand all the things we want to teach them. Take them time to understand. Look, the news is on. I want to hear it. I know you want to tell me all about what's happening, but I want to hear the news. The news is only on for a few minutes, and then it'll be over. You will still be here. You could still talk then. But no, they don't get it. They keep talking. You don't hear it. That's the things that we understand as adults. But children don't. They see things different. I want to tell you now. No, now is important. This is it. That's why we have to understand this concept of fear. They're not afraid of us, but they're afraid of losing us. And that's the attitude we have to with God. Because we are always telling him things too, you know, at inappropriate times. And we think it's important. But really, it's not all that important. And we realize later it's not all that important for it already dealt with. But, you know, at the time, it was a real panic. So you get those things. Fear is the factor that is used to control. People, for example, who have idols fear that if they don't worship and make their offerings to the idols, their crops mightn't grow. They fear that if they don't ask gods for their protection, an enemy might attack them. And at all times, if you examine it, what they're saying is, if we don't appease our God, then he's going to bring disaster on us. So their fear is always that they're going to offend God, and God gets angry and he hits them. And that's the problem, because that's not Christianity. And that's not the image that we should be representing in any way of our God. Our God does not retaliate in kind. He's loving, he's thoughtful, he's considerate, and he's long, long suffering. The very fact that we're all here is proof of that. The very fact that half the world is in total rebellion against him is proof of that. They're still out there. They're not destroyed. Why? Why does God not decide to control us with fear? Wouldn't it have been easier? I mean, think about it. In every religion, in every state, fear works for an extent of time. They bring the people under control. They can make people do what they want. Fear does that. So why doesn't God use fear? Well, it's because God wants a relationship that is not forced. He wants the relationship that you agree to. And that's important. He wants you to agree to him. Do you remember I said in the Garden of Eden, a problem happened with the image of God. And that was that the image died. It became just a physical man in the sense that he lost contact with God and no longer truly represented God. We have to understand that when we are spiritually dead, God cannot be represented in us. It's not possible, because God is life. God is love. God is joy. God is fullness of truth. And dead limit that severely. God is invisible. Who can know him? This is a statement made in the Bible. You find it in Corinthians chapter 1, verse 15. Who is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation? That's the invisible bit. In Romans chapter 11, verse 32, you will read in verse 33, how changeable are his judgments and his path past finding out. And in verse 34, for who has known the mind of God, or who becomes his counselor? Yet, we know that Jesus Christ knows the mind of God. And we know that Jesus Christ has the fullness of God indwelling in him. Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 5. I want to just bring this up because this is something that causes a lot of bother. The living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. Nor do they have any more reward, for their memory is forgotten. And the reason I wanted to bring that up is because that's what's happened to mankind generally. You see, mankind has a problem. He thinks he's alive, but he's spiritually dead. And the spiritual bit is the important bit. So without life, he can't do nothing. He has no way of continuing. He has no contact. He's like a battery. I like putting it this way. A battery has life to a degree, but it's not going to continue. As you use the battery, the life goes down until finally there's no more power in the battery. It can't do anything. And there's no option but to throw the battery out. The electric, on the other hand, is always there. It doesn't run out. And a bit like your spirit, in a sense. When you were connected to God, you were like on the electric. You were filled with energy, power, all the rest. But when you were separated from God, you were like a battery, slowly running down. You need another power socket. You need some way of being made alive again. And Paul tells us that's exactly what happened to Christians. We became new creations. And new creations, is totally different from what sometimes we think of it as Christians. Consider this statement. If someone was making something new, he's not working with something that's broken. He's not working. If he was working with something that was broken, he'd say he repaired it or he fixed it. Isn't that right? If he was changing its purpose from what it was originally intended, then he would say he was altering it. God doesn't use any of those words to describe what's happening to us. We're being made totally and completely new. And why are we being made new? Because ultimately, every part of you that exists now is of no use to God. Your eyes are of no use to God. Your memories are of no use to God. Your body is of no use to God. So all of that will waste, decay, and pass. But you're going to get a completely new body. You're going to get a completely new mind. You're going to get a completely new everything because you're a new creation. And you're new because everything is changed. Every part of you. With the return of Jesus Christ, approximately 2,000 years ago to this earth, for the first time since Adam and Eve, the true image of God walked this earth. Since then, the true image of God has continued to walk this earth in you, because Christ is in you. You are the image of God. I want to close with one thought. Throughout this, I've pointed out that Satan has counterfeited God at every point. And he's done that simply because he's created idols and images to try and persuade people they need to be worshipped. In the last days, in Revelation chapter 13, 15, we are told of a beast that is to rise. But it's going to have an image. And it's that image I want to bring to your attention. Because that image of the beast was given the ability to speak and to act so that whoever would not worship the image of that beast would be killed. Why would Satan go to the point or to the extent of going to this point where he needs an image of the beast that's so powerful? It's because the image of Christ, the perfect image of God, is alive and well on the earth at the time. And that's you. Thank you.